Welcome to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live again from east of the Appalachian Mountains.
The spice extends life.
Super Bowl Sunday, everybody on our block is eating up all the bandwidth on this internet. So you'll have to bear with us tonight. It might get a little choppy. And besides, you'll have to be one of the ultra faithful to hang in on Super Bowl Sunday. Tonight at 6 p.m. Pacific time, we have Kevin Smith coming on. We have a Lake Vostok update. Lots of controversy going on with that project anyway. But I think you will immensely enjoy it because it's always a pleasure to have Kevin Smith come on the program. The solar wind tonight is 414.5 kilometers per second, and all of the sunspots on the Earth side of the sun are magnetically simple and quiet. And the sun's X-ray output has consequently flatlined. It doesn't mean it's dead. It's just very quiet. NOAA forecasters estimate the chance of significant flares today to be no more than 1%. So if you're planning any travel out there, you're safe. Earth passed through a minor solar wind stream on February 4th, yesterday. The weak impact of the solar wind was just enough to spark auroras around parts of the Arctic Circle, if you live up that way. The effects of the solar wind are subsiding, and the auroras might disappear into the moonlight for the next few nights. Geomagnetic activity is expected to hover at low levels for the next 48 hours. Hey, we're glad you're here with us here tonight at X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. As I mentioned, we have Kevin Smith coming on the program tonight. Always, always a pleasure. Lots and lots of stuff in the news this week. Holy cow. Nuclear reactor loses power and it is venting steam. Is this the Stuxnet virus showing up again? Officials at a northern Illinois nuclear power plant believe a failed piece of equipment at a switchyard caused it to shut down. You know what a switchyard is? This is where the big switchgear is that controls motors and transformers. As we told you earlier in the year, various solar activity can put a significant amount of stress on switchgear, especially at these high voltage yards, because what it does is it pounds high-energy protons, high-energy electrons into the atmosphere. This is picked up by transformers that normally step down voltage from high-voltage switchgear. And it steps it up. And when it steps it up, it fries the primary coils, overheats the unit, and fries the coils. And this takes a key piece of switchgear out of the system. And if it happens on a large scale, according to my colleague Michio Kaku, we could be out of electricity in regions of the United States for months at a time while these transformers and various switchgear are rebuilt. They said the investigation into the equipment failure is ongoing. Unit 2 at Byron Generation Station shut down around 10:18 a.m. Monday after losing power. Generators began supplying power to the plant. Operators began releasing steam to reduce pressure, though not from within the nuclear reactor. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission has declared it an, quote, unusual event, the lowest of its four emergency classifications. Officials say the steam content contains low levels of tritium. You might know is one proton, two neutrons, and an electron. This is a radioactive form of hydrogen but it only has a half-life of about 12 and a half days. So not too dangerous, not too much more dangerous than hydrogen. The plant is about 95 miles northwest of Chicago. So no worries, mates. Also in the strange weather category, and we don't really get strange weather reports from Alaska, but we've had two or three this year. You know, about a month ago we had 90-mile-an-hour winds. We had record snows, something like 22 feet of snow. They were shoveling like crazy, all those Alaska people up there trying to get their schools and stores and roads and gas stations out from underneath the snow. Well, now there is bitter cold records broken in Alaska. Oh, yeah. And you're going to like this story because all-time coldest record nearly broken. But the only reason it wasn't broken, you're going to like this. While the continental USA has a mild winter and has set a number of high temperature records in the last week, I have personally heard people say, it's global warming, we're all going to die. And pundits ponder whether they will be blaming the dreaded global warming for those temperatures. Alaska and Canada have been suffering through some of the coldest temperatures on record during the last week. Now, this is the crazy thing. For example, in Circle Hot Springs, Alaska, on Sunday, a week ago, the high temperature was a blistering 49 degrees Fahrenheit, breaking the minus 44 F record, which has stood since 1917. But it gets better. In the same day, in Circle Hot Springs, the same neighborhood, the low temperature was minus 58 degrees Fahrenheit, breaking the old record of minus 52, set in 1941 by a whopping 6 degrees. While all this was happening, the weather station in Jim River, Alaska, closed in on the all-time record coldest temperature of minus 80 degrees F in the shade. In the sunshine, I mean, minus 80 degrees F set in 1971, which, by the way, in 1975, I was in Grand Forks, North Dakota, the tropical paradise of, and I saw minus 76. So, yeah, let me tell you, that was the winter of all winters for my lifetime. I had no respect for anybody who said it was cold at 28 degrees F. Minus 76. Yeah. A quart of fresh oil freezes at about that temperature. Anyway, that's not the only Alaska all-time record, but the record for the entire United States. Unfortunately, the weather station stopped reporting at minus 79. Yeah. The thermometer broke. Had the thermometer been working, they would have recorded the all-time lowest temperature. Now, of course, if the wind is blowing, the wind chill is like dark side of the moon temperature, okay? You can go out with the proper clothing and you can make your way to the bar to have a beer if it's that cold, if you have the right clothing. But if the wind is blowing, forget about it. You're on the dark side of the moon at that temperature. Last week, I drove to West Virginia, or through West Virginia, to Detroit to do some business. I'll let that sink in just for a second. It's a beautiful country, beautiful forests, beautiful river, Interstate 77 going north. But on my way, I saw several billboards that said, "Welcome to Obama's no work zone." It stuck in my mind, and it surfaced again today when I read this story by Matt Cover. I want you to listen to how American energy giants are using environmental groups to do battle against one another. Yeah, it's competition out there, okay, for who's going to generate electricity. Because as you might not know, any coal-fired power plant, any coal-fired power plant starts up on natural gas. It does. They broadcast the coal out onto a moving chain belt. And then they light up a big gas burner. And the gas burner generates enough heat to light up the coal. Well, the belt moves slow enough so that the coal forms an ash bed on top of the chain conveyor to insulate the chain conveyor from the heat of the coal. Once the coal bed gets thick enough, then the chain begins to move forward and, you know, conveys the ash off into an ash hopper where that stuff is recycled. But in the meantime, the heat is generated. It boils water in a boiler, which then sprays onto a turbine, which turns, and that is connected to a generator, which generates electricity for all the homes in the surface area. But the same thing can be done with a natural gas. You can just not put the coal on the chain belt, and you can light the boiler up with natural gas, and you can run the power plant on natural gas. So the two forms of energy have been fighting it out. And this coal-fired power plant located in Ellinger, Texas, the liberal environmentalist group Sierra Club admitted that it took $26 million in donations from a major natural gas company and used the money to fund the group's anti-coal campaign. So the natural gas folks were battling against the coal folks, and this is what happened. And I quote, "In 2010, soon after I became the organization's executive director, I learned that beginning in 2007, the Sierra Club had received more than $26 million from individuals or subsidiaries of Chesapeake Energy, one of the country's largest natural gas companies." This is Sierra Club Executive Director Michael Brune on the Sierra Club website. Now, Brune said that the reason the Sierra Club took the money was that it felt that it shared a common purpose with Chesapeake Energy, ending the use of coal. That was their common purpose. He goes on to say, "The idea was that we shared at least one common purpose, to move our country away from the evil, dirty coal." The story first broke Thursday in Time magazine, which reported that Chesapeake CEO Aubrey McClendon had made the bulk of the donations to the Sierra Club. Brune said that when he took over in 2010, he put an end to Sierra's relationship with the natural gas industry. He goes on to say, "We cannot accept money from an industry we need to change." Very quickly, the board of directors, with my strong encouragement, cut off these donations and rewrote our gift acceptance policy. Brune said the move came because the Sierra Club no longer supported the natural gas industry, due in large part to the environmentalist movement's opposition to the practice of hydraulic fracturing, known as fracking. That is becoming increasingly common as companies try to develop more of the nation's natural gas resources. Now, I have to tell you, as a qualified expert in the oil and gas industry, that not all of this fracking takes place with hydraulic pressure. A lot of this fracking takes place, it's a term known as fracturing, okay? We call it fracking in the industry. It is not hydraulic. It is not explosive using dynamite, but it uses acid. They actually pump sulfuric acid down into the formation. The acid eats at the soft rock, increasing the porosity of the formation and allowing the oil or gas to flow to the hole, which has been drilled in the ground, sometimes 1,000 to 3,000 to 4,000 feet deep to allow these resources to make their way to the surface. So fracking takes place in a lot of different forms. Now, the reason that fracking has come under some scrutiny lately is because that it sometimes eats through the soft rock, either through hydraulic pressure, acid, or explosives. And it connects the aquifers, that is the water formations under the ground, to the petroliferous zones, the areas that contain oil or gas. When the two mix, well, it doesn't bother the oil much, but it makes a terrible transition for the water. As if you're trying to irrigate crops or you're trying to pump it up into drinking water formations, then you have a terrible pollution problem that's deep under the ground. That's why fracking has come under such terrible criticism of late, although it has been practiced since the late 40s. Anyway, by mid-August 2010, with gas industry practices and our policies increasingly in conflict, he goes on to say, I recommended to the board, and it agreed, to end the funding relationship between the club and the gas industry and all fossil fuel companies or executives. The move drew the ire of fellow liberal groups, including the United Mine Workers of America, which called the Sierra Club a knee-jerk shill. They say, this is the president, Cecil E. Roberts of the UMWA, he's the president, he said on Friday, the Sierra Club cynically put people at risk for years to come with this campaign and made themselves little more than tools of an energy industry competitor in the bargain. Let's get real here, Roberts says. Just like any business, the gas companies are about selling gas, period. And they will gladly funnel cash to any organization that will help them do it. Roberts said that instead of taking money from the natural gas industry to attack its competitors, Sierra should put its efforts into supporting clean coal technology. The quote is from the Sierra Club. Well, actually from him, instead of merely being a knee-jerk shill for a competing industry, the Sierra Club would do well to take a step toward joining with those of us who seek not just a cleaner, but a more stable and secure long-term energy future for our children and grandchildren. Brune, however, said that the only alternative to fossil fuels were the longtime environmentalist favorites, wind, solar, and geothermal energy, not clean coal or natural gas. Ultimately, the only safe, smart, and responsible way to address our nation's energy needs is to look beyond coal, oil, and gas and focus on clean, efficient energy sources such as wind, solar, and geothermal. My two hands are in the air, making the sign of a touchdown. Brune is exactly right. So what is it about coal that is so bad compared to natural gas? Well, it used to be the sulfur. Now we only use low sulfur coal for the fuel. And the other coal is used for other purposes than for burning. The other item is CO2, otherwise known as bad breath. Yes, people put off CO2 as well. In fact, it is a normal product of respiration for all life on Earth that breathes air. Plants, including algae, respond to increases in CO2 by absorbing it and turning it into sugar. Levels of CO2 have come up slightly since records have been kept, and I'll qualify that here in just a second. But plant growth and algae presence in the oceans increases to take care of it usually. By the way, natural gas is considered clean burning by most, at least by the natural gas industry, and puts out exactly the same amount of CO2 per ton of carbon as coal. Now, I did some research on my own, and according to the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, NOAA Earth System Research Laboratory, since 1960, now it is now 2012, we have records up to 2011, pretty close. Since 1960, the parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere, this is taken at the Mauna Loa Observatory, have gone from just under 320 parts per million to just over 390 parts per million. That's roughly 70 parts per million increase in 62 years. It is a steady trend upward with a small standard deviation of about 0.26 parts per million. And we don't know if this is significant, but we do see spikes when volcanoes erupt or there are large, you know, like forest fires and such. Nature tends to sequester and even metabolize the extra CO2, and the growth rates do have a tendency to settle down. It's been fairly consistent. One thing is for sure. The combustion of American coal is not changing the rate nearly as much as Asian combustion of coal. China has immense reserves of natural gas and is using them to make energy. Coal is also used in Asia without the pollution controls the U.S. uses. Honestly, I think the $26 million given to the Sierra Club's campaign was poor form. Definitely poor form. Way to go, Sierra Club. You should have known better. Also in the news, oh, by the way, don't forget, in about 15 minutes we have Kevin Smith coming on with an update of Lake Vostok. We sent it out on our Facebook and on our Twitter accounts today. He called me earlier this morning to tell me that he has an update on Lake Vostok. It's going to be interesting. I don't want you to tune away, although the Super Bowl is ongoing. And I know those commercials are so hard to tune away from. But I already told you. I already sent it out there, okay? Three lead changes and the Patriots win by less than a touchdown. 7 points or less. 7 points or less, Patriots, and there will be three lead changes. So far, everything is on schedule exactly as we saw it from the year 2015. So just so you know, if you're watching or listening to this program on Monday morning and you did watch the Super Bowl on Sunday, it is currently 8:45 Eastern time. The game is not over yet by your time. And you will see that our prediction was correct. Actually, it's not our prediction. It's our recollection of the future. If you have any questions about that, you can buy the book called Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel. It is available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, everywhere where fine books are sold. Or if you want the audio version for free, if you're not a great reader, don't worry about it. I read it for you. You can get it at rememberingthefuturebook.com. Rememberingthefuturebook.com. Yes, the screenplay has been written, and it is out there to Hollywood. And it is going through the process right now, and that would be rememberingthefuturemovie.com. So it has not been launched yet, but that's where we're going. Also, as you're making your plans for the year, do not forget you are about to turn in your W-2s, your 1099s, and you're about to do your 1040 EZ or your 1040. And undoubtedly, you are going to get some of the money that you loaned interest-free to the federal government back. And when you do, you need to make some plans for this year because, after all, it is 2012. And you know where you want to be on December 21st, 2012. You know where you want to be. You want to be with me and some of the best speakers in the world at the Maya 2012 conference in Chichen Itza. You can do this. You can see yourself there. All you have to do is go to xsquaredradio.com, click on the orange banner on the right-hand side under the affiliates column. It says Maya 2012. Let me tell you, you will not be let down. Some of the world's best speakers, Greg Braden, myself, and others are going to be there. This is ground zero for the Maya revelation that the calendar created by the ancients is going to come to its reset point. It's control, all delete. It's reset. It's zero. It's 12 o'clock midnight. The age of Aquarius is about to dawn, and you want to be able to tell your grandchildren where you were when the clock struck midnight. You want to be in Chichen Itza where the great King Pakal revealed to the world for the first time 1,500 years ago what would occur in the year 2012. You can be there. You can be there with us. All you have to do is take some of that money, go to Maya 2012 and make your reservation. And let me tell you what else is going to be going on down there. Rumor has it that Sting and Carlos Santana are going to be playing at the same venue, in the same area. You're going to be there with us going from December 13th to December 22nd. You will be home for Christmas, I promise. Maya 2012. Do it. Also in the news, we have about 10 minutes before Kevin Smith comes on. You know, we have been covering the story about John Corzine, the amazing John Corzine, governor, senator, and CEO of MF Global Holdings. Nearly 3 months after MF Global Holdings collapsed, officials hunting for an estimated $1.2 billion in missing customer money increasingly believe that much of it might never be recovered, according to people familiar with the investigation. And by the way, according to Ann Barnhart, it is not $1.2 billion. By the time it settles out, it will be $3 billion worth of investors' funds. And we're not talking about funds that were invested. These were not funds that were invested in commodities, in gambles. These were funds that were in people's savings accounts with MF Global. Cash that hard-working, trusting Americans had put away for their retirement. And Mr. Corzine stole it. As the sprawling probe that includes regulators, criminal and congressional investigators, and court-appointed trustees grinds on, the findings so far suggest that a significant amount of the money could have vaporized as a result of chaotic trading at MF Global during the week before the company's October 31st bankruptcy filing. A person close to the investigation was cited as saying Monday, former chairman and CEO of MF Global, John Corzine, testified during a hearing before the Oversight and Investigations Committee of the House Financial Subcommittee last month. Many officials now believe certain employees at MF Global dipped into the customer segregated account that the New York company was supposed to keep separate from its assets, because it belonged to their depositors. This was not money that was invested. This belonged to the depositors. This belonged to their clients. They stole it out of their accounts when they ran short. Rather than protecting their clients, they just took the money. They just took the money. And I'll guarantee you that Mr. Corzine didn't miss a paycheck. I'll guarantee you that his officials didn't miss a paycheck. Officials investigating the case have looked into whether such investments were appropriate under rules at the time. Yeah, right. As money poured out of MF Global, much of it likely passed through J.P. Morgan Chase and other banks where the securities firms had accounts, as well as trade clearing partners such as Depository Trust and Clearing and LCH, ClearNet Group, people familiar with the matter said. Those companies have denied being knowingly in possession of any missing MF Global money. Oh my gosh, pardon me while I roll my eyes. And any effort to make them fill the hole would face daunting hurdles. And because the firms usually were middlemen between MF Global and other counterparties, the funds they touched were then scattered widely, complicating the search. Of the $6 billion kept at MF Global by farmers, hedge funds, floor traders, and other customers when panic erupted over its exposure to European sovereign debt and shaky financial outlook, About $5.3 billion has been located, according to James Giddens, the bankruptcy trustee for the securities firm's U.S.-based brokerage operation. But hundreds of millions of customer dollars are potentially snarled in litigation with other parts of MF Global, including its UK arm, and U.S. officials might never be able to recover those funds. Go figure. I guarantee you those people made their house payments. I guarantee you those people's retirement funds are in no jeopardy whatsoever. Ann Barnhart says that Corzine's MF Global was just the tip of the iceberg. More funds will fall, and Europe will fall, and there is no stopping it because there is not enough money in the world to cover the debt that these animals accrued with hard-working people's money. They all need to go to prison. Their assets need to be liquidated. Their 401ks, their retirement funds, their gold, their holdings, everything needs to be cashed in and make up that money to those people who deposited it with them. That's all I have to say about that. High-quality global journalism requires investment. So I want to make sure you people stay involved in this, stay close to it, pay close attention, because it means a lot. It means a lot to me, and means a lot to the people that watch it. And there's a lot going on. There's a lot going on. You know, we're talking about the Iraqi dinar getting ready to reevaluate. Sources say that it has already reevaluated. Rumors abounded. Sometime about a month ago that said that the Iraqi dinar was going to reevaluate it somewhere around $3. I can tell you that's utter nonsense. It isn't going to happen. The Kuwaiti dinar did reevaluate somewhere around $3. But remember, that was a short-term war. It was a limited amount of currency. People didn't know about it. They didn't capitalize on it. It did reevaluate around $3, and those people that were able to get in on it made a ton of money. But the Iraqi dinar is completely different than the Kuwaiti dinar. Lots of people have cashed in upon it, and maybe rightly so, I don't know. But so many people have cashed in on it. So many people have bought Iraqi dinars, and I'm not talking about a few million, a few billion. I'm talking about a few trillion with a T. That it is probably going to revaluate somewhere between a nickel and 16 cents per dinar. If it is not so, the inflation would exceed 3,000%. You ever see 3,000% inflation? I've seen 1,500% when I was in Mexico with the peso. 3,000% inflation is possible in Iraq. It would be crushing to their economy. That's why it will not revaluate at $3 per Iraqi dinar. It will revaluate somewhere between 5 cents and 16 cents. Okay? So if you're out there holding 10 million Iraqi dinar that you bought for $1,000 per million, you're going to get somewhere around $150,000 back. Not bad. Not bad for a $1,000 per million investment. You're going to make about 15, 16 times your money. Not too bad. But I don't want you to be shocked. And please don't go obligating yourself like you're going to make the lottery, because it ain't going to happen. Okay? All right. Let's talk a little bit about oil. Oil is obviously bouncing up a little bit. It jumped about $4 or $5 a barrel this week. The Straits of Hormuz have been threatened with mines, have been threatened with cruise missiles. Don't worry your little mind, okay? It is going to bump up oil a little bit, and it's going to be an economic game, okay? The market is driven to about $111 by the geopolitical situation in the Middle East. I don't think the Iranians are going to do much than rattle the trash can lids. Scientists have determined that Earth's missing energy isn't missing after all. Earth's primary energy source is the sun, which bombards the planet with solar rays every day. Some of you have the sunburn to prove it. This energy helps drive our weather system, makes the planet warm enough for life, and drives photosynthesis in plants, among other things. But not all of this energy is retained by the Earth. Some of it is reflected or radiated back out into space. It's called the albedo. By studying the amount of solar energy absorbed by the atmosphere and comparing it to the energy released back into space by the planet, a team of researchers has calculated how much energy is retained by the planet. Most of the energy is held within the oceans as heat. The influx causes a slow rise in temperature. Now, is the energy missing or not? A previous study released by a different group in 2010 noted that the ocean heating from 2004 to 2008 seemed to slow. This led them to suggest that some of the planet's energy was missing. But the new team, led by Norman Leob of NASA's Langley Research Center, re-examined the numbers measured over the course of the last decade and found them to be relatively stable. Loeb's team maintained that the margin of error was larger than the original study took into account. He goes on to say, one of the things we wanted to do was a more rigorous analysis of the uncertainties, Loeb said in a statement. When we did that, we found the conclusion of missing energy in the system isn't really supported by the data. Using a decade's worth of data collected by the Solar Radiation and Climate Experiment, the team determined the amount of energy absorbed by the sun. They then subtracted the energy reflected back into space, as well as the energy emitted by the Earth using the clouds and the Earth's radiant energy system. The energy left over is trapped somewhere on Earth. Less than 10% of it heats the land and atmosphere and melts snow and ice, while the rest heats the ocean. Quite a calculation on a global extent. The original study found that the Earth's temperature, which had been steadily rising, slowed its pace. But the new study notes that the methods for measuring characteristics of the ocean shifted in 2003. When accounting for the margin of error of both methods employed, the new study states that the apparent decline is not statistically significant, nor is it observed by the study. Currently, data on the ocean is collected via the ARGO program, which has dropped over 3,000 floats in salt water around the world. They monitor the temperature. They also monitor the floats sink and rise, and they measure the salt content. Loeb says, our data show that Earth has been accumulating heat in the ocean at a rate of half a watt per square meter with no sign of decline. A gravity mapping spacecraft orbiting the moon has beamed home its first video of the lunar far side, a view people on Earth never get to see, because we only get to see the man on the moon. We only get to see the same side of the moon all the time, whether it's dark or whether it's a fingernail or whether it's a full moon. The new video was captured by one of NASA's Twin Grail probes using a novel camera called MoonCam. What a great idea, MoonCam, which will eventually be used by students on Earth to snap photos of the lunar surface as part of an educational project. The two spacecraft have been circling the moon since they arrived in orbit over the new year. The quality of the video is excellent and should energize the MoonCam students as they prepare to explore the moon from Earth on their computer screens, said Maria Zuber, Grail principal investigator from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Cambridge, in a statement accompanying the video's release today. Hang on a second while I send a second phone number for Kevin Smith. Let's see here. Oh, hold on one moment. Hold on just one moment. I find it hard to talk and type at the same time. Don't you? Yes, I do. And I think some of you, based on my following you down the highway, find it difficult to drive and text at the same time. I, on the other hand, can multitask. And so I actually can type a number and I can speak at the same time. So there we go. All right, now we have all the numbers to the studio. We're going to try and raise Kevin Smith. We have a Lake Vostok update coming to you any second, and I think you will enjoy it. Anyway, the pressure's on globally on oil. As you know, we've dropped our dependency on oil just a little bit this year. And I'm not exactly sure because I haven't finished my economic evaluation of the math yet. But I'm not really sure whether we're driving less or whether we're using less because our cars get better mileage, or whether we're shifting our usage into other means, electric and hybrid and others. So I'm not really sure what it is, but it seems that our oil usage has gone flat. And for some reason, we've gone from 64% imported oil to somewhere very close to 50% imported oil. And we're not really sure if we have a way out of this. We don't know if here's the difficult problem I'm having just before we get Kevin on the program. When I listen to the speeches given by President Obama, whether it's a new jobs program that was given at a local fire station a few days ago, the Veterans Jobs Plan, or whether we're talking about various speeches that are given at various opportunities, of course we know he's not in campaign mode yet. Not really. It's difficult to tell whether Mr. Obama is really dedicated toward electric cars and alternative energy and, things that are clean and renewable. Because when we go not even a whole layer deep into his administration, we find that the secretaries of the various agencies, bureaus, departments, administrations are doing something quite radically different than what he is actually saying at the bully pulpit. Now, we don't know whether his secretaries and cabinet members are not listening to him or whether they are listening to him and the bureaucrats underneath them are not listening. But what we see is a pile. And you can fill in the parentheses however what load pile you think it is. A pile of regulations that seem to stack up against new energy, against clean and renewable sources coming to the market. It is frustrating, it is confusing, and it is extremely costly to see small business struggle against what seems to be an insurmountable challenge to coming to market. We don't see it. We're not getting it, Mr. President. You're not getting through to your staff. Your staff is not getting through to their staff. And their staff is not getting through to the bureaucracies. We're still seeing a dozen regulations a minute that are making their way to the books that are blocking these technologies from coming forth. So if you want us to believe you, Mr. President, and believe me, I want to believe, but I'm a scientist. I got to see some data here. I got to see something that backs up that you're telling us the truth. I'm not saying you're not telling the truth, but I'm not seeing it. In the immortal words of O'Reilly, I'm not buying it. But I will tell you that if the Republicans keep beating each other up in the press as badly as they are, I'm going to reelect Obama, And then I'm going to vote to fire his Congress. All right? And that's where I'm coming with that. If you have any comments on that, I really want you to join our program. We've got Kevin Smith coming on in about 3 minutes. I'm running just a little bit long, but hey, I'm entitled. Okay, I'm entitled. Because this is internet radio. And I can stop when I darn well please. If you want to be part of the program, and I encourage you to do so, although it is Super Bowl Sunday, and the TV is playing to my right, and I'm really tempted to look over there, but I know if I do, I'm going to jump up and down and say, all right, or something silly like that, and you're going to catch me. I do want to look over and see the score, but I encourage you to be part of the program tonight. If you have the Super Bowl score, the current score, you can call in. It's 888-429-5471, although I don't know why you'd be listening to this program and watching the Super Bowl, even though I'm doing it. 888-429-5471, anywhere in North America. Anywhere else on planet or off planet. And by the way, I highly encourage you to do so. There's no solar radiation to worry about tonight. The sunspots are as quiet as they're going to be and have been in a couple of years. So you can be out there if you want to, and you should be able to reach a cell phone tower unfettered. It is 530-413-6472. If you really want to sit there and have a good time, dial us up. Dial us up at 760-569-7676, and then put in the passcode 534-355-POUND, 534-355-POUND. You can listen to X Squared Radio with your Bluetooth, and you can watch the Super Bowl at the same time. What could be better than that? Let's take a quick break, a little bit of enigma, and we will be right back with Kevin Smith on X Squared Radio. Don't go away.
Bye.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. Little Enigma, goodbye Milky Way. We're coming to you live from east of the Appalachian Mountains. Our guest this hour is going to be Kevin Smith. As you know, Kevin Smith's show, kevinsmithshow.com. Good friend, one of my mentors in this business. Got me to the level that I am today, everything that I am as far as a host. I owe to him. He's given me a lot of good pointers. He's joining us tonight because we're going to have an update on Lake Vostok. You know, the Russian venture turned into multinational venture to drill through the Antarctic ice cap into a sub-ice lake that was discovered a couple of decades ago. It's taken a long time to get through that ice down to the discovery in the depth. And amazing discoveries down there, because this lake is probably 60 miles long. And last year's flyby by a special aircraft outfitted with sensors discovered a long metal, what seems to be object under the ice. And recently it began leaking some radioactivity. Kind of interesting. And so... you know, the plans were to drill into it. Of course, the NSF, the National Science Foundation, involved with it, along with the Australian group that's designed to control the ecology of this discovery. Obviously, once you think about it, you don't want to let the headspace above this lake leak into our atmosphere. What if there are some ancient microbes in there for which we have no immunities? And likewise, you don't want to contaminate that pristine environment with what we've been doing to our environment. And so some measures have been taken after looking at the venture to prevent that from happening. But the appearance of this radiation brought in the National Security Administration, the NSA, and they have offered some oversight over it. And now, just a few days ago, according to Fox News, the drill punched through into the lake's headspace. That's the atmosphere above the lake. And suddenly, unexpectedly, communication stopped. We don't really know why. We don't really know if, because we've had some official denial that a lack of communication has actually occurred. So we'll talk about it for this hour with my good friend Kevin Smith. Welcome to the program, Kevin. How are you?
I'm doing very well and pleased to be here. It's always a joy to be on your show.
Well, I appreciate it more than you know. We have talked about this story from time to time. You know, a group of Russian scientists. People don't really realize how terrible the conditions are in this region. How long do they actually get to drill in a normal year down in this remote region of Antarctica?
You know, I'm not sure, but it's not very long. And the drop-dead date for doing any work is the 6th of February. That's tomorrow. Because they have to be battened down for winter by the 6th. Winter is well and truly set in after that. And Lake Vostok Russian station at Lake Vostok is the place where the lowest temperatures on Earth have been recorded. 189 degrees minus.
Wow. And, you know, that's not a temperature that you want to have humans at a station working through the winter. You get to work for about 8 or 9 weeks in the summertime. That's our winter time up here in the northern hemisphere. So, yeah, sometime around the first week of February, it's time to call it quits, batten everything up, and head out. So what happened 7 days ago?
Well, the story, as it was reported by Fox News, they got an email from Dr. John Prescu. Dr. Prescu is a professor on the faculty of the Minnesota State University, and he is there on a project for the university, and apparently sent Fox News an email in which he described that the last he heard from them, they were 40 feet from punching through, which isn't much. You know, 40 feet can go pretty quickly. And they were 40 feet from punching through, and that's the last he heard. He's had no contact with them since. I did a show about this on Friday night reporting it, and when I opened the telephone lines for the audience to call in, we had a caller who said that as soon as I began to talk about this, he went right on line to see if there were any updates, and there was. He found an email had been sent from Prescu to, I guess, Fox News, but I'm not sure about that, in which Prescu said that, "I'm sorry that I said it. Communications have not been cut off with them." Well, I've been looking for that. I can't find that. And I'm not saying that my listener lied by any means. I'm not saying that. I'm saying I haven't been able to find that. I think it's interesting, though, that Fox News has done no update since that original story.
Oh, I do, too. I do, too. You know, I found the correction, but it's short. It says, a team of Russian scientists trying to uncover the prehistoric Lake Vostok miles beneath the surface of Antarctic ice are not lost, according to American Antarctic explorer John Prescu. He says, I can assure you that they are not lost or out of contact, he wrote in an email, doesn't say to who. And he says, I never said the Russians were lost. Fox News reported that...
Well, and I made that point Friday night, that when we say they're missing, we only mean that they're missing from communication.
Right.
It doesn't mean they've disappeared. And I made that point Friday night in the show.
And it doesn't say who the email is to, even though it may be from him. I'm sure it wasn't to your caller, but it wasn't to me. It wasn't to you. So I don't know what they're talking about. You know, a lot of people are not familiar with Lake Vostok. It's been in the news for well over 20 years. Mm-hmm. And they get to drill, you know, two or three weeks a year. And this isn't like drilling for oil, okay? This is like a large, long, you know, soda can about or a tomato can. And what they do is they heat up kerosene and they drill down into the ice to capture a large ice core. And then they snap it off and they pull the core to the surface. They gently lay the ice down into a refrigerated, well, it doesn't have to be too refrigerated down there in Antarctica, but they lay it down into a room and they save it because this is their record. Now, they've drilled 13,000 feet through this ice over the years. This is ice that has not been exposed to air in more than 20 million years. So that gives you an idea how pristine of a record they're trying to capture. They don't just dig it up in chips and, you know, save it as ice cubes and, you know, put it in their vodka. This is a record. This is a couple of house trailers sitting out on the ice that they get to drill 3 or 4 or 5 weeks a year. And it's slow going, people. So it's a slow, meticulous, careful process. It warms up to about minus 40 degrees centigrade, which is also minus 40 degrees Celsius. It's actually the only temperature where those two scales are the same. And it gets down to well over minus 129 Fahrenheit in the wintertime. Obviously, not a place where humans can hang around. So they get a short drilling period. But what happened last year that made this really obscure kind of science project really hit the news, Kevin? What made it so notorious?
Well, it actually goes back beyond last year. This lake is 160 miles long. It is 30 miles wide. It's 1,129 feet deep. Once you get down to the surface of the water, it's 1,129 feet to the bottom. There are two basins that form this lake with a ridge between the two basins. From the top of that ridge up to the surface of the water is 700 feet. So there's a lot of water here. In size, it's roughly the size of Lake Ontario. In volume, it's three times the volume of water. And so this is one thing that makes it so important, is because it's such a huge body of water that's under the ice. And of course, it's liquid water, so that means it's we would say warm water, but folks, that's not quite your definition of warm. It's average temperature, they say, is about 37 degrees Fahrenheit, so just barely above the freezing point, but it's liquid. In the 19th century, it was theorized by a Russian scientist that there would be these lakes under the ice cap in Antarctica. Then in 1973, a British team doing radar surveys got returns that indicated to them that there was, in fact, fresh water under this area we call Vostok. In 1991, Jeff Ridley did basically what we would call an MRI. He also had some satellite scans done and verified what the team in 1973 had said. But his work in 1991 was not published until 1993. That's when it got really interesting, because then JPL and NASA got really excited. They said, this is great. It's a place right here on Earth where we can test these fancy pieces of equipment we have that we want to send to these other planets and moons of planets to drill down into the ice to get to what we think is an ocean, for instance, on Europa.
Right.
So JPL and NASA took all their stuff and went over to Vostok. And in preparation for what they were doing, they did an MRI of the lake. And as they flew over the lake with this equipment, they reached a point where the magnetometer just pegged out.
Really?
And they thought there was something wrong with the equipment. So they recalibrated, checked it, flew over it again. Same thing, same spot, it pegged out. All of a sudden, at that point, NASA and JPL pack everything up and book it back over here to the States. Now, there was a press conference, and at this press conference, the spokesperson for NASA was Deborah Schingteller. And she was asked, well, you know, you spent all this money going over there, and you were, you know, going to do all this experimentation with your equipment? Who made the call? Who made the decision? And she said that it was under the direction of the NSA for national security reasons. She was ushered off of the stage. Her assistant took over, and a day or two later, the statement came out that, well, she had, instead of saying NSA, she should have said NSF. She just got kind of mixed up. Well, the NSF is the National Science Foundation, and they would not have taken over for national security reasons.
Right, exactly.
But Ms. Shingteller was never available to the press again after that, although people did call and try to get statements, and they would ask for Deborah Shingteller, and they would be told, hold, and then they would be told, well, I'm sorry, she's not in. And then when they asked for her voicemail, they would get someone else. So it's a big, big mystery about that. All right, now 7 days ago. 7 days ago, there were many, many radio shows, many internet articles and blogs where people talked about this magnetic anomaly. There were people who claimed that it is an ancient structure. There are people who claim that, it's just sort of, I'm sorry, just sort of a thin spot in the Earth's crust, that's what's causing this magnetic anomaly. Is 65 miles by 45 miles square. The fact is, nobody really knows what that is. At least nobody out in the public domain. And since NASA and JPL left, the Russian scientists, that's their station there anyway. You know, Vostok is a Russian name, and it's a Russian name because it's the Russian station that's there. And it was there before they knew there was a lake. And so basically they said, well, okay, if NASA and JPL are not going to drill, we will. And so they really began in earnest about a year ago. And then 7 days ago, they were within 40 feet of punching through, and communications were lost, according to the Fox News report, which was according to the email they received from Dr. John Prisco. Then all of a sudden, this other email shows up saying, well, I didn't mean to say that. They're not lost, communications are down or broken. Or at least communications are cut. We can't communicate with them. Okay, I can buy that. And I never said, and I don't think anybody else really did either, that they were missing physically. They're missing in action on the radio, on the Iridium satellite phones that they have. But they're not. Nobody, as far as I know, reported that they were missing physically. However, I got a strange email this morning, Brooks, and that's why I telephoned you as you were having breakfast. I got an email from one of our listeners who said that after listening to my show, he went on Google Earth to try and take a look at Vostok, and they have it blurred out. So here's the mystery as I see it. One, we have no communications since 7 days ago. If indeed these guys are okay, then why in the Fox News report do they tell us that they asked for comment from the NOAA and NOAA would not respond? They asked for comment from the National Science Foundation's U.S. Antarctica program, and they would not respond. They asked for comment from the U.S. ice drilling program that's in Antarctica, and they would not respond. Nobody would respond. And to date, as far as I know, nobody has responded. Nobody has produced these scientists. Nobody has put a camera in their face and ask them, are you okay? I have sent email to Dr. John Priestku, and I have not gotten a response from him. The silence is screaming. And you know me. You know what I always say. When there's a black hole in the information, the truth is being hidden right in there.
Well, and there's a lot of coincidence because, you know, I tried to explain to our listeners that this drilling is slow going, people. I mean, it's, yes, they're using hot kerosene. Kerosene, as you know, doesn't freeze no matter how cold you get. But they use hot kerosene to lubricate this metal can that they lower down with a cable, and they actually turn it so that it can cut down through this frozen ice just by its sheer weight. And once it gets down to a certain depth, they capture that core, snap it off, haul it all the way back up to the surface, 13,000 feet to the surface, lay out the core, store it, lower the can back down again. It is a slow-going process, 33 feet at a time. It seems amazingly coincidental that just as they're ready to break into this headspace of this lake, which is a space that has been observed for the better part of three decades, and we've really known about it globally for probably the last 10 years and have really been concentrating on it for the last year. A lot of funding has gone to it, more experts in drilling and in core preservation have gone to it. But now we're getting close to breaking through into the headspace. And so I remember, late last year, the Australians got involved because they're heading up the ecological preservation aspect of this, as far as the National Science Foundation is only part of the participation. And they said, look, we cannot contaminate this pristine environment with our environment. We've got to take some precautions to kind of seal off the two as we break into this. And the other thing to consider is that we've got some strange microbes that might exist in the headspace of this lake, and we don't want to release them into our atmosphere, something for which we have no immunities as the modern human race. You know, you don't want to release some virus into the atmosphere that wipes out the whole human race because we haven't seen it in a few million years. So once these precautions were put into place, the right experts were put into place, you would think that it would be pretty smooth going after that. The idea that this new technology to be mounted into a spacecraft and launched to a moon of another planet to do some subterranean analysis of what's under the soil or what's underneath ice caps on various moons of various planets is put into an aircraft and flown past this area for kind of a flyby scan. And lo and behold, they pick up this magnetic anomaly. And I believe that they picked up some kind of radiation signature, which speculation could say is a leak from some kind of power supply underneath this ice cap. You know, ice is not a very good block of for radioactivity, so it makes its way to the surface pretty easily. They have repeated this experiment a number of times, this measurement a number of times, and have determined that something not natural is down there. It's not just uranium. This is a radioactive signature that would lend one to believe that this is something enriched. It's not just normal background radiation. So all of these things put together and the missing communication from the dozen or so scientists that live in these insulated trailers, which are stuck out on the ice by this drill, really makes it suspicious, don't you think, Kevin?
Well, yes. I mean, it would be suspicious all by itself, but the overwhelming silence makes it even more suspicious. You know, this is the kind of story that you would expect major media to be all over. Now, whether they want to admit it or not, Fox News is now part of the major media. And they, as far as I know, are the ones who broke this story about these guys being out of communication. You would think if they're in possession of this email, and have written their report based on this email, that they would be following up on this hot and heavy now, because, you know, their reputation for fair and balanced reporting is right on the line here. Did they accurately report based on the email they got? Now, that could be solved by publishing the email. Secondly, if they did, why has there not been follow-up reporting? Now, follow-up reporting, yeah, okay, they ran a statement, a correction, that he didn't say they were missing. That's true. He did not say they were missing, but he did say they were out of communication. All right, it's been 7 days now. Their first report came out on February the 2nd. At that time, actually, you know, let's recalculate. February the 2nd is when the Fox News first reported that they were out of communication for the past 5 days. February the 3rd, they ran the correction stating that he did not say, Dr. Priskou did not say they were missing. So now they're out of communication for 6 days. That was on the 3rd. Okay, and this is the 5th. So they are now out of communication for 8 days. Am I correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Okay.
Now, I mean, they could just be busy little.
If they're okay, why is there not a picture of them? Why is there not an interview with them? Why is there no video? It is difficult to get news out of Antarctica. There's no telephone system. You can't call in to Antarctica from here. They have Iridium satellite telephones, and if you happen to have the number to one of those telephones, you could call it.
Well, but I think they should give us
that number. There's no telephone exchange there. No telephone system.
They should give you and I that number.
Do what?
I think they should give you and I that number. We need to be able to call those people and find out what's going on.
Yeah, now this could be as simple as somebody dropped the telephone down the hole.
You remember there's 65 tons of kerosene down that hole.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of kerosene.
You're not going to go down after this phone.
No, and you realize they got to pump some of this kerosene out. Once they drill to the point where they hit fresh water, they got to pump some of the kerosene out in order to equalize the pressure. This is how they intend to isolate the pristine environment of Lake Vostok from our atmosphere, is this column of kerosene that's in between the two. But keep in mind, bacteria grows quite nicely in kerosene. It is, uh-huh, after all, a fatty acid.
Well, and it's very, very likely that there will be life in that cavity, because by whatever means, they have determined that it has 50% more oxygen than what we have out here on the surface.
Wow. That's pretty amazing.
So, you know, you might even get a little flash fire or something. But And that's a lot of oxygen, 50% more in a cavity the size of Lake Ontario. So, you know, there's likely to be life in there of some kind. And if you have any complex life, you absolutely have to have simple life, because without the simple life, the complex life can't feed.
Well, that's true. That is very true. So this magnetic anomaly, do you think it's just a thinning in the crust, or do you think there's some kind of structure down there that's metal or somehow interrupting the magnetism, the background magnetism of the Earth at that location?
Because of the very strange events of that press conference that I told you about and the disappearance from the public eye of Ms. Shingteller, because of that, I assume that the official story is not true. The official story is that it's a thinning of the Earth's crust. If Ms. Shingteller had simply misspoken, and it truly was the NSF instead of the NSA, don't you think her assistant would have stepped up and bumped her elbow and said, NSF?
Yeah, I mean, why make a woman disappear after that? You know, no public appearances, no access to the public whatsoever after a mere misspeaking. I think that what she said was accurate, that the National Security Administration was one of the agencies that stepped in and exercised its oversight on this, not because they were getting ready to break into a pristine ecological lake, but because they were getting ready to discover something that was not natural, that was somehow either melted through the ice millions of years ago or has been hidden under the ice for millions of years, and its reactor has started leaking, and that's what made up the magnetic anomaly.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, I can't say that I know that to be true, but everything in the very sketchy information we have points to the direction that this is something not natural. Her statement, and it's in quotes, is because of national security concerns, the NSA shut it down.
Now, why would the National Science Foundation be in the least concerned with national security?
Well, that's a good question, isn't it? That's a good question. And, you know, when someone just makes a slight misstatement, saying NSA instead of NSF, it's normal, it's natural for an aide to sort of clear his throat and say, NSF. You know, it didn't happen that way. She was ushered from the stage. He was replaced, said it was NSF. He didn't. It was a couple of days later that the NASA spokesman, who, let's see if I can pull up very quickly here who that was, Frank D. Carsey from JPL, tried to put an end to all of that by saying she misspoke. Instead of saying NSA, she should have said NSF. So that was Frank D. Carsey from
the National Science Foundation gives out grants during its from its Polar Research Division. I know this because you know that I have a polar research project going on the other side of the planet. And that Polar Research Division has no concern whatsoever with national security. They give grants to universities all over the world.
Right. Yeah. So because of the strangeness of that, the events around that press conference, I would assume she told us the truth, and I would also assume that means that whatever's down there is not natural, but it's an artificial structure. It's a built structure of some type. And if it does rise to the level of national security, if that's the case, and I stress if, because, you know, everything about this is sketchy, but if that's the case, I think that what we're looking at is some more high technology that's not from this planet. Not only do they not want you to know about it, it is perhaps dangerous technology.
Well, one thing's for sure. Here we are on the 5th of February. The Antarctic winter is about to kick in full blast down there and last for several months. If they're going to make their way through a winter that gets down as cold as 130, 140 degrees below zero, They better be getting some serious equipment down there and some serious manpower down there to make their way through to the iciness of winter. If not, they got to leave this thing alone for about 8 months until somebody can get back down there during the Antarctic summer to continue the project. This thing's going to have to go, you know, unobserved for about half a year.
Yes, and if they did not actually punch through, then that is the case. If they did punch through, and if that is the reason for the silence, the reason could be a couple of things. Let's say they punched through, and that's the cause of the silence. It could be because there was some type of disaster that befell them. It could also be that somebody dropped the phone down the hole. But it could also be they punched through and discovered what that anomaly is.
Well, weren't they supposed to send a camera and a light down that hole once they punched through and illuminate the area and take a look around down there?
Yeah, but let's think about that. You ever been fishing?
A few times, yeah.
You ever been fishing at nighttime?
Yes, I have.
Have you ever seen how unwell you can illuminate the surface of water?
Oh, you can't do it all.
That's right. So now you punch down into a cavity that's over something the size of Lake Ontario, and you're going to illuminate what?
Yeah, with a 12-volt flashlight.
What are you going to, you know, the only way, the absolute only way that camera and that illumination, that light, will have any use whatsoever is if you're punching through the hole near the edge of that anomaly so you can turn the camera around and take a look at the anomaly.
Yeah, exactly.
Otherwise, you're going to see nothing but darkness because the water is going to be nothing but dark. The cavity is going to be nothing but dark. There's nothing to look at there.
Yeah, there's nothing to reflect the light back and have a look at something. Because the roof of this ice cavern is several hundred feet above the surface of the water.
Yeah.
And in the water's 1,000 feet deep, so it's not like you're going to, you know, reflect light off the bottom and see anything. You just can't light up water that way.
No, you can't. You can't. And so, you know, the only way that a camera and a light have any value whatsoever is if they intended to punch through near the edge of the anomaly and take a look at it. And I suggested on the show just a what if. And what if they miscalculated and drilled right into the top of that anomaly? And what if it took exception?
Hmm. Well, I would think, given the size of this lake, it would have to be pure luck. If they determined where the anomaly was long before they actually admitted, you know, to the rest of the world that they had done so, then they could relocate the drill and start over again and try to drill in on top of it. But as I mentioned earlier in this hour, you know, that drilling is pretty slow going, and they're wanting to catalog these cores that they drill up and collect and catalog, because, you know, that ostensibly is the real value of this drilling. If they thought that, well, we need to find out what this thing is on the edge of this, on the shore of this lake, you know, 13,000 feet under the ice, then I don't think they'd be concerned at all with saving the cores. They just, you know, drill like a banshee and try to get down to it as quickly as possible, which they have not been doing.
Well, it was not the intention of the Russian scientists in the beginning to save the cores. That's something that they had to agree to get the drilling permit. There is a commission, as you mentioned, the Australians are heading it up at the moment. There's a commission for Antarctic ecological preservation, and it's run by people there on Antarctica. in order to drill like this, they have to get a permit from that commission. And they had to agree to these scientific things and these ecological things in order to get that permit. So that's not something that they originally wanted to do. They just wanted to drill a hole and get there. And, you know, it's, I think the interest of the Russian scientists is primarily, let's get there and see what's there. The interest of other people in Antarctica was save the ice cores and test for this and test for that. And so they had to agree to that in order to get their drilling permit.
Well, that's true. That's true. And then that's what I was saying. As long as they're adhering to the scientific nature of the expedition, and they're down there drilling it up and collecting the ice and cataloging it for other grad students for years to come to sample and say, you know, this is what volcano erupted 200,000 years ago and blah, 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 then everything's fine. But as soon as they discover this anomaly and there's some kind of national security interest, and of course by national I'm saying United States national, not any other country national, not Australia, not China, not Russia, but the United States national, then you know, the all-encompassing ever suppressing arm of unfree speech comes clamping down upon it, and none of the information gets out. And that's pretty consistent with not being able to hear from the scientists who are making or actually doing the work down there for 8 days, right?
Well, yes, it's extremely suspicious. It's the sort of thing that when you add it to everything else that has happened related to Vostok, when you add it all together, makes for a huge mystery. Not a little one. It's a huge mystery. I cannot imagine that Fox News can't get more information. But let's assume they can't. Then the question is why? What's happened?
Yeah, that is the question. And, you know, the fact that it's the NSA, American NSA, and not the Russian NSA, if the Russians have an analog of the U.S. National Security Administration. It is, they are Russian trailers, they are Russian scientists, it is Russian labor that's drilling this hole. Why, in what would be considered international areas of the Western Antarctica, would the United States take precedent over this? Do you know?
Well, yeah, I do. And I think everybody does. Russia has claim to Vostok. Several nations have set out claims to certain areas there. Nobody actually owns it, but they've staked out a claim that that's their area to work. America has not staked out any claim, but has reserved the right to do so. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that. I mean, you know, this is 6,000 square miles of free Western Antarctica that has not been claimed, you know, by the United States until when?
Well, but this particular area has been claimed by Russia. And just like you have New Swabia claimed by originally the Third Reich and today modern Germany. This area has been claimed. It is Russian. And it's not that they own it. It's that they've staked out a claim that this is their area they're going to work in. Okay? America has staked no claim and has the largest base down there. So, you know, it's sort of a case of America just kind of does what it wants to do in terms of the, you know, Antarctica. And it's, you know, if it's something that the NSA thinks is in our national security interest, whatever it is, it doesn't bother them to step over into somebody else's claim and say, okay, here's how it's going to be.
Yeah, I mean, that's a little bit like claim jumping. Yeah, we'll let you do all the work. You drill the hole for 9, 10, 12 years, spend all your money, and if you find something, we're going to step in and claim it. What? That doesn't make any sense.
Well, and that's not actually what I'm saying, although I guess they could do that. I could try it anyway. I'm just saying if they think it's in our national security interest, then America's going to throw its weight in. Now, I'll give you a very clear modern-day example. There is a place on the other side of the planet where we have no state, no territory, no nothing. But it's called the Strait of Hormuz. And when Iran said, and they are there, that's where they're located. When they said, we're going to block it, America and Britain stepped up their activity and said, yeah, well, I suggest you don't try that. So it's a matter of just throwing weight in the direction of something that is deemed to be in the national security interest of the United States. And that could be what has happened here. And I'm not saying that for sure that's what's happened. Remember, this information is very sketchy. And it's sketchy on purpose. They make sure that not much information comes out of Antarctica. Until this article appeared on February the 2nd by Fox News, until that article, when's the last time you heard anything really about what was going on in Antarctica?
Well, it's been a while.
Yeah, not much news comes out of it. And the biggest amount of news that came out in any single period of time, well, the biggest amount of news probably was Operation High Jump with Admiral Byrd. But since Operation High Jump, which I believe was 1948, until Vostok was the hot item, there just wasn't much coming out of Antarctica. All of a sudden, in the 90s, a lot of information was coming out of there about finding this anomaly and people getting sick and scientists being evacuated from Antarctica because they had gotten some strange disease working at Lake Vostok and so forth.
Yeah.
There was a lot of news in the mid-90s, and a lot of that came to us via the Art Bell Show, and a fantastic show. The world would be a better place if that show was still going, but it's not. But Art Bell brought us most of the news that we got during the 90s out of Antarctica. And now, it pretty much fell silent until February the 2nd. Now, I've been doing my show for 11 years, and over the 11 years, in 2000, when I started, Vostok was one of the shows that I did in 2000. And over the years, I've done a number of shows on Vostok. I've just sort of kept my eye on it and sort of updated as we went along.
Uh-huh,
there hasn't been much. And then February 2nd, big news. And then what happened? It went silent.
Lights out.
Yeah. And, you know, I follow the silence. I think you probably know that about me.
Oh, yeah.
When there's something that somebody doesn't want to talk about, there's a reason.
Yeah, I believe that. Of course, you look at it from, you know, a law enforcement point of view, a different point of view than most people. You know, I look at it when it shows back up again. We say, hey, wait a minute, weren't we concentrating on this? Weren't we talking about this 3 or 4 months ago? Maybe late last summer we were talking about Lake Vostok and that they were going to try and step it up and maybe drill through the winter because they were getting really close. And that's when the Australians step in and say, no, you can't do that because we don't want you to contaminate the environment. So continue drilling next summer. So they shut it down. And then they did the flyby and they found the anomaly. And then the NSA stepped in, you know, NASA or JPL's statement. It just got messy. It just got messy. And frankly, I, you know, turned my sights somewhere else and you kept watching it. And here comes this statement, not by some obscure science magazine at the back of a journal. Fox News says it. I mean, this is tough.
You know, I just have a habit of that, though. The silence is where the truth is. And, I mean, think about it. I mean, for those who are in the audience, think about this. How many times have you heard this little joke? How do you tell if a politician is lying? If his mouth is moving.
Yeah, that's right.
All right, so it's a little joke we all tell because that's basically the truth. But what does that imply? The silence is where the truth is. What he won't talk about is where the truth is. That's what's really going on.
Well, that's it.
That's true in the media. When the media goes silent on something, that's where the truth is.
Yeah, and sometimes the media... multiple aspects of it, and politicians will jump on the bandwagon, you know, waving their flag and saying, over here, over here, over here. And all you really need to do is just look over to the side where they're trying to direct your attention away from, and you see
the truth
as well.
That's true. You
know, I hear...
this is a non-statement by Prisku where he says, I never said they were missing. Okay. Nor did I. Where are they? I never said they were missing. Okay. Where are they?
Well, they're probably down there in the trailer watching the Super Bowl right now.
Maybe. It could be. And why haven't we had a story that says we have confirmed that they have been in communication? We talked with their team leader, Vladimir, whoever he is, and everything's okay. Why haven't we seen that?
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, if you look at Prisku's
if you look at Prisku's public statement, it's a little cagey. You know, it's a little, hey, I didn't say they were missing.
Right, and he didn't. Fair enough. Okay, so what he said was there's no communications, there's no way to get in touch with them. And what I'm saying at this point is we've had from the 2nd till today. If communications have been reestablished and they're okay, why haven't we seen the story that says we can confirm that, look, Fox News has the satellites. They have the ability, if they really want to, they can call and talk with people in Antarctica. You and I can't, but they can. All right. Why haven't we seen the story that says we have confirmed that this team is okay and they're, you know, everything is hunky-dory in Antarctica? Well, the reason we haven't seen that story is because that event has not happened.
You're right. You're right. It has not happened. And, you know, the nature of this situation is such that they should be going to whatever lengths are necessary to make sure that the rest of the world knows that those people are okay. And that should have taken place in 24 hours. Doesn't take long to fly a plane out there.
How about Fox News, if they can't get in touch with Antarctica, get in touch with the Russian Academy of Sciences and get a statement?
That's exactly right. And, you know, if I was the Russians or I was the Australians and I knew that they had punched through into this environment and we hadn't heard from them in 24 hours, you know, there would be a plane on skis headed that way within an hour.
Yeah. And they have that. They have those resources.
Sure they do.
So, from my point of view, the story is the silence.
Yeah, the story is the silence, exactly.
And, you know, usually in politics they say follow the money. I say follow the silence.
Good point. Good point. Well, my guest tonight for this hour has been Kevin Smith. His program is called KevinSmithShow.com. And he is on Monday through Friday on webcast radio. He is arguably the number one webcast talk radio program in the world and has been my mentor for many years. X Squared Radio is a Sunday night program, so Kevin was gracious enough to come on my program tonight. And tomorrow night I will reciprocate and be on Kevin Smith's program, and we'll talk about this. I'll try to get a few more details during the day tomorrow. I appreciate you coming on the program, Kevin, and I really appreciate your helping me become a better host, refining my style and my sound, and helping me be successful in this industry.
Well, you're certainly welcome to all of that, and it's my pleasure to be here.
All right. Kevin Smith, thank you very much for being on the program. I'll let you have the rest of your Sunday night back out there. You're on Mountain Time, right?
I never give my time zone. I'm from somewhere on Earth, broadcasting to everywhere on Earth.
Yeah. I like it. I'm in an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains.
My location is so secret, I can't even find it.
Yeah. That's why you never leave. You're there all the time, wherever it isn't.
That's true. That is true.
All right, my friend. We'll see you tomorrow night on the KevinSmithShow.com.
All right. Looking forward to it. And again, thanks.
All right. Have a wonderful evening. That was my good friend Kevin Smith. Has been a part in the background of X Squared Radio for a number of years. Always helped me with my equipment and my technical problems, and helping me improve the sound and quality of my program. Answered a lot of questions for me as far as staying in this business and being able to keep the lights on. And by the way, I want to let you know, if you're watching the Super Bowl or have watched the Super Bowl, in the first part of this program, I brought you back a memory from the future, from the year 2015, of Super Bowl 46, where the lead changes three times and the New England Patriots win by less than a touchdown. Up until the last 3 seconds, the last 3 seconds of Super Bowl 46, my memory was flawless. Had the New England Patriots caught that last pass in the end zone, they would have won with three lead changes by less than a touchdown. The good news is we are now on a parallel alternate future path. That's correct. We are now on a parallel, alternate future path. Everything from this point forward is in motion. And you are part of it. And I am so glad that you were able to join me tonight. We'll be back for the last hour of X Squared Radio right after this. Don't go away. More X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, coming up after this little Lorena McKinnon. Back to X Squared Radio, third hour. Super Bowl Sunday 2012. Lorena McKinnon, one of my most favorite female vocalists. You ever get a chance, I don't think she's doing concerts anymore, but some amazing experience to listen to her music. Amazing musician, amazing singer. Lots of neat things coming on. Our last hour, we had Kevin Smith on from The Kevin Smith Show, one of my good friends and mentors over the years, arguably the top webcast radio program on Earth. You know, we have sent several spacecraft to the moon lately, and we recently completed a gravity mapping of the moon. We beamed its first video home of the lunar surface of the far side of the moon, a view people on Earth never get to see, at least from here, because the same side of the moon always faces the Earth. It revolves on its axis at precisely the speed with which it orbits the Earth, so we only get to see the same side all the time. This video was captured by one of NASA's Twin Grail probes using a novel camera called MoonCam, which will eventually be used by students on Earth to snap photos of the lunar surface as part of an educational project. The two spacecraft have been circling the moon since they arrived in orbit over the new year, about a month ago. The quality of the video is superb, and it should energize the MoonCam students as they prepare to explore the moon. I do have a link that I have captured about this, and I think you'll find it interesting. It's pretty short. We'll play it right now and let you listen.
I'm Maria Zuber, principal investigator of NASA's Grail mission. Grail is the first planetary robotic mission that includes an imaging experiment that's devoted entirely to education and outreach called the MoonCam system. This video clip was made by Ebb as it flew above the surface of the moon that we don't see from Earth, from the North Pole towards the South Pole. The far side of the moon is extremely rugged. The surface also contains many impact craters, which are preserved features from asteroids that hit the moon's surface after it formed. The MoonCam investigation will begin in March, when middle school students will have the opportunity to target interesting areas of the moon that they want to study. So stay tuned.
So there you have it. That's all about the MoonCam. And the students that the program is aimed toward are not necessarily college students, but middle school students, to inspire them and keep them pointed toward toward space and toward exploration. I would like to have your opinion on something. I've asked a few friends of mine, and I get such a wide variety of opinions. I want yours as well to kind of balance it out a little bit. And that is, candidate Newt Gingrich said recently down during his campaign speeches in Florida that he wanted to return to the moon not just with a manned mission within the term of his prospective presidency, but to establish a moon base. And I would like to have your opinion. If you're not listening live, that's fine. You can write me at bagnew@x2-radio.com, bagnew@x2-radio.com. And I'd like to have your opinion of what you think about the validity, the practicality, the benefits, the costs of what you think a moon base program might bring us. Our toll-free number, 888-429-5471. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, we have listeners in Australia, New Zealand, and even in China and Japan tonight. It's a 530-413-6472, 530-413-6472. Let me know what you think about a prospective lunar program to establish a base, whether it's Newt or someone else that proposes it. I've had my share of street opinions on it. I would like to have the opinions of my listeners tonight. Also, you got to know that the government is all over stuff, and they're making such rabid changes, rabid and rapid changes in the way that they interact with, I was going to say the citizens. It could very well be the subjects of this government. There is a no-fly list, as you well know. If you try to go get on an airplane and fly a jet somewhere, a commercial jet somewhere, and you're on that no-fly list, you're going to run into some problems. You may be able to get on the plane, but you're going to be in a paper bag probably. Did you know that the no-fly list has grown by more than 100%? It's true. The size of the U.S. government's secret list of suspected terrorists who are banned from flying to or within the country has more than doubled in the past year. Not over a period of time, listeners. In the past year. The no-fly list jumped from about 10,000 known or suspected terrorists 1 year ago to about 21,000, according to government figures. About 500 are U.S. nationals. The flood of new names began after the failed Christmas 2009 bombing of a Detroit-bound jetliner, when the U.S. government lowered the standard for putting people on the list and scoured its files for anyone who qualified. I was flying around the Christmas 2009 period, and it was tough. Timothy Healy, who's the director of Terrorist Screening Center, which produces the no-fly list, said this: "We learned a lot about the watchlisting process and made strong improvements, which continue to this day." Well, among the most significant new standards is that a person doesn't have to be considered only a threat to aviation to be placed on that list. It's true. You could just smell bad. I'm kidding. People considered a broader threat to domestic or international security, or who attended a terror training camp, are also included, said a U.S. counterterrorism official who spoke on condition of anonymity. As agencies complete the reviews of their files, the pace of growth is expected to slow, the counterterrorism official said. Now, I got to tell you, people, if you're out there attending a terrorist training camp, give them another name. Or something. You realize that those mailing lists are shared with everyone, okay? And it doesn't necessarily have to be a terror training camp, okay? There are things like the NRA. There are things like the Militia of Montana. There are things like, various activist groups, hackers. The profile now is what? A middle-aged, college-educated person who has said something against the government. Hello, that's about 40% of Facebook people. So be careful out there what you're doing. The American Civil Liberties Union has previously sued the U.S. government on behalf of Americans who believe they are on the no-fly list and have not been able to travel by air for work or to see family. Nusrat Chowdhury of the ACLU says, "The news that the list is growing tells us that more people's rights are being violated. It's a secret list, and the government puts people on it without any explanation. Citizens have been stranded abroad. Well, people who complain they're unfairly on the list can submit a letter to the Homeland Security Department, but the only way they'll know if they're still on the list is to try to fly again, she said. While the list is secret, it is subject to continuous review to ensure the right people are on it and that those who shouldn't be are removed, said Martin Reardon, a former chief of the FBI Terrorist Screening Operations Center. So, just interesting. If a person is nominated to be on the no-fly list, but there is insufficient information to justify it, the person is downgraded to a different list, he said. We can't just say, here's a name, put him on the list. You've got to have articulable facts. On average, there are 1,000 changes to the U.S. watch lists every day, most of which involve adding new information about someone on the list. The no-fly list previously swelled to 20,000 people in 2004. At the time, people including the late Ted Kennedy, a sitting senator, were being stopped before flying. Well, I could see Ted Kennedy being on it. No, I'm just kidding. Come on. The U.S. Transportation Security Administrator John Pistole, or Pistole, said instances of travelers being mistaken for terrorists were, however, down significantly since the U.S. government and not airlines became responsible for checking the list. Travelers must provide their full name, birth date, and gender when purchasing airline tickets so the government can screen them against the terror watch list. Also in the news, by the way, if you own some Facebook stock, you may be among the 1,000 new millionaires that have been generated. It's the best investment ever, some are calling it. It's the biggest liquidity event ever, some are saying. It's about to unleash a new wealth wave in America. It's a boon to wealth managers and Palo Alto realtors. It's going to solve California's budget problems, help fix our education system, and feed the poor in Africa. But the most widely repeated superlative about the Facebook IPO is that it will create 1,000 overnight millionaires. How about that? So if you're one of the 1,000 overnight millionaires from investing in Facebook, my email address is bagnew@brooksagnew.com. I'd be happy to provide you wiring instructions. Also, in the news, we've got about 20 minutes left in the program tonight. I just did want to let you know that we are in a parallel timeline as of the last 3 seconds of the Super Bowl. Just so if you feel a shift, that's what it's from. Scientists have known for decades that hidden under those impressive vistas at sites such as Death Valley and Yellowstone National Park are magma pools that under the right conditions can trigger explosive eruptions. We're not talking about ordinary volcanoes here. We're talking about super volcanoes. These are pools of gas which are kept in liquid form because they're under immense pressure and temperature, not far beneath the surface of the Earth. Now, for decades, these areas, both at Death Valley and Yellowstone, have been swelling. That's what they call it, a groundswell. We're not talking a big, huge mountain jutting up out of the ground, you know, like Hawaii, where you have magma that makes its way to the surface and cools, makes its way to the surface and cools. We're talking about a large bubble underneath the ground. Now, if the pressure is relieved on this, like through a crack or a mild eruption, then all of that liquid flashes to gas, and this is what's called a supervolcano. Now, new research is changing scientists' understanding of the timing of those eruptions and prompting them to call for greater monitoring of sites to help save lives when the next big volcano explodes. Two recent papers, and I mean just in the last few days, highlight the shift. One looked at a Death Valley volcano thought to be 10,000 years old and found it had last erupted just 800 years ago, and it is still in eruption danger. The other found that large caldera volcanoes, such as the one under Crater Lake in Oregon, can recharge not in centuries, but in a matter of decades. Okay? The understanding of the timing of eruptions and the timing of the building up to eruptions is changing. It's upgrading. Margaret Mangan, the scientist in charge of volcano monitoring in California for the U.S. Geological Survey, says these two papers are very nice examples of good scientific work. Well, a scientist might say that. A person living near these or downstream from these might say that's a pretty dramatic study. One thing that's coming to light is that eruptions are often clustered with long stretches of inactivity punctuated by periods of activity that can go on for years, Mangan said. The first paper looked at the Ubehebe crater at the northern end of California's Death Valley. It's about half a mile wide, 700 feet deep. It was long believed to have been caused by a volcanic eruption sometime in the past 10,000 years or so. However, researchers recently looked at beryllium in the rocks and were able to date the last series of eruptions to just 800 years ago. That's a big difference, several millennia off from the previous assumption. They say the ingredients necessary for another eruption are all still there. Ubehebe crater is the result of what's known as a fritomagmatic eruption. That means that it has a huge pocket of molten rock or magma deep below it. When it begins to push to the surface and comes into contact with water, super hot steam is created, building up pressure until it explodes, and it doesn't take long. It has been thought that the eruptions would occur only during wet climate periods. And as Death Valley is famously dry now, there was little concern. But using U.S. Geological Survey data, the scientists show that the current water table may be just under 500 feet below the surface of the crater. The paper was published this month in the journal Geophysical Research Letters. The relatively recent eruption means that the magma underground, which can take thousands of years to cool, is likely still hot. When water and hot magma come into contact, it can produce something like a very large bomb going off, said Brent Goering, a geochemist at the Department of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at Purdue University in West Lafayette, Indiana, and one of the paper's authors. Another worry is that caldera volcanoes such as Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines and Krakatoa in Indonesia may be able to blow much more quickly than previously believed. Caldera volcanoes consist of large underground lakes of magma, molten rock. As more magma builds up, the pressure builds, and the magma starts getting pushed upward through cracks in the Earth's surface. When the pressure gets too great, well, it explodes. Caldera volcanoes typically have a long, quiet period prior to eruptions. Writing in Wednesday's edition of the journal Nature, researchers looked at the eruption of the Santorini volcano in Greece about 1600 BC, which released as much as 12 cubic miles of magma. By analyzing feldspar crystals formed within the magma and then ejected during the eruption, the researchers found that the volcano's magma chamber grew by as much as 10% in the final few decades before it blew, says Tim Druitt, a volcanologist at Blaise Pascal University, Clermont-Ferrand, France, and senior author on the paper. For this reason, scientists are calling for greater monitoring, including satellite surveillance, to detect ground swelling. As you know, Yellowstone has been the subject of a lot of ground swelling measurements, and lakes that are sitting on the floor of Yellowstone have flowed deep into the forests and are now surrounding the trunks of many of the trees because the ground has swollen so high that it's actually pushed the lakes and made them flow deep into the woods. There are still several large and still active calderas in the United States, including the one under Yellowstone National Park. All are closely monitored, and what worries the researchers are other unmonitored calderas around the world with the potential to send huge clouds of ash into the atmosphere, causing massive ecological and climatic damage. One of my colleagues, Michio Kaku, has some words to say on that. We'll play it right now so you can hear what he has to say about it. It just adds a little dimension to it.
Wyoming, land of geysers, mountains, and lakes, is also sitting atop a super volcano. And it just took what scientists describe as a deep breath, causing miles of ground to rise dramatically. So what does this mean? Well, joining us right now is Michio Kaku. He is a physics professor at the City University of New York and the author of the upcoming book, Physics of the Future. Thanks so much for joining us.
Glad to be on.
So the last time this happened was 640,000 years ago. We're due.
We are due. Forget Yogi Bear. Okay, forget Old Faithful. It's on sitting on top of a sleeping giant. Now, if you're sleeping next to an 800-pound gorilla, you monitor every burp, every snore of this gigantic gorilla, because when it blows, it could destroy the United States as we know it.
This is a pretty scary prospect. I want to just show people what we're talking about here when we talk about this super volcano, and we have a little thing to show you, a map with some of the details. So that's where it is. It's beneath Yellowstone. It's been there, as we know. I guess this has erupted three times in 2.1 million years. But what they're worried about is the fact that they say that the ground has started to swell in levels that they have not seen before, 10 inches in some places in the past year. What does that tell us?
It tells us that there is activity in this supervolcano, which erupts roughly every 600 million years. And the last eruption was 640 million years ago.
Oh, 640 million or 1,000?
1,000 years ago. I'm sorry.
Because then we had some more time.
Then we have some more time, right. But that's what's making us very nervous, because the cycle time corresponds to the present-day era. So every single burp, murmur of this gigantic potential supervolcano, including the rise of the sea level, has to be watched very carefully.
All right, so when we talk about this, and we have pictures of Mount St. Helens erupting back in 1980. Let's just show this right now. You say that an explosion with this supervolcano under Yellowstone, and there we're seeing the Mount St. Helens, would be 1,000 times bigger than this. What type of damage are we talking about here?
We're talking about immediate damage out to 100 miles from the site. That is total devastation, basically wiping out everything in sight. However, the real damage goes out to 500 miles if you include volcanic ash, poisonous gases, death of wildlife and vegetation. And that's a ring about 1,000 miles across. That's the heartline of America.
It would pretty much wipe out Earth as we know it.
It would wipe out the United States as we know it. And again, we don't want to panic anybody. It could happen tomorrow, or it could happen 100,000 years from now. It's black magic trying to predict exactly when it's going to blow. But we do know one thing. One day, it will blow.
So, and you say that something on this scale is what wiped out the dinosaurs.
65 million years ago, another supervolcano coincided with this meteor that hit Mexico. And we think it was a double whammy that knocked out the dinosaurs. So it's something that we take very seriously. But again, the cycle time is measured on the scale of hundreds of thousands of years.
Would there be anything we could do to prepare or to get people out? I mean, how much of a warning might we get with this eruption?
All you can do is run. You don't get much warning. What happens is the ground starts to rise. More and more earthquakes take place. More ash and volcanic gases start to be unleashed. That's about the only warning we get, because we do not have a good way to predict volcanic eruptions.
Are we getting a better way to do it, or are we just at the mercy of Mother Nature?
We're still clueless. We're still monitoring it very carefully, looking for the warning signs. That's why this sudden rise in the Earth, even though it's not immediately dangerous, is being looked at very carefully, because we have no experience with supervolcanoes. We've seen Mount St. Helens. We've seen Krakatoa, but a super volcano erupting in our lifetime, we have no understanding of the scope of that thing. We just see the evidence of previous eruptions.
It's amazing. So you say it could be tomorrow, it could be in 100,000 years, but it's under there.
It's there, and it will happen. At one point, it will destroy North America as we know it.
Well, that doesn't mean that it will destroy North America. It just means that it's going to harsh our gig, okay? So I would say that if you live 100 miles east of Yellowstone, you probably need to think about selling while the market is hot and moving east or moving north from there or south from there. I would say Kentucky, Tennessee, North, South Carolina, and Virginia are pretty safe. Just from what I can see, the last time that Yellowstone did its thing, the ash settled as far as the eastern side of Nebraska. So there's a lot to be considered there. Just trying to keep you posted, so you know what to do with your future. You know, those of you that saw the movie Contact. It was written by a wonderful astronomer, Carl Sagan, criticized by some, but probably popularized astronomy more than anybody else of his day. And I really like the movie. I like the story about Elle Woods growing up, for all intents and purposes, an atheist, and then having an amazing experience on a dimensional ship that was designed by aliens and built by U.S. engineers or American engineers. It surrounds an organization called SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. In the last decade or so, it kind of died off. And people were like, you know, we've been listening for a long time. We spent a lot of grant money. We haven't really gotten anywhere. We've sent signals out, but you know, people, you got to realize that these signals are going out at the speed of light. They have to get outside of our solar system to get any place interesting. They're subject to the solar wind, the galactic wind, and all kinds of potholes and speed bumps in the way. And so funding kind of died off and things kind of laid around. But the story is the stuff of science, and it's best, you know, it's discovery, it's exploration, and not acting upon the universe so much as innocuously listening to it is SETI, operating on money and equipment scrounged from the public and from Silicon Valley millionaires, and on the stubborn strength of their own dreams. A band of astronomers recently restarted one of the iconic quests of modern science, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, SETI for short, which had been interrupted last year by a lack of funding, really after 10 years of decreasing funding, and only last year became interrupted. But early in December of 2011, a brace of 42 radio telescopes known as the Allen Telescope Array, nestled here in the shadow of Lassen Peak, came to life and resumed hopping from star to star in the constellation Cygnus, listening for radio broadcasts from alien civilizations. The lines are now open, but with lingering financial problems, how long they will remain that way is anybody's guess. These should be boom times for those seeking out aliens, or at least their radio proxy. Astronomers now know that the galaxy is teeming with at least as many planets, the presumed sites of life, as stars. Advanced life and technology might be rare in the cosmos, said Jeffrey Marcy, the Watson and Marilyn Alberts in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence professor at the University of California, Berkeley. But surely they're out there, because the number of Earth-like planets in the Milky Way galaxy is simply too great. A simple howdy, a squeal or squawk, or an incomprehensible stream of numbers captured by one of the antennas here at the University of California's Hat Creek Radio Observatory would be enough to end our cosmic loneliness and change history, not to mention science. It would answer one of the most profound questions humans ask. Are we alone in the universe? Despite decades of space probes and billions of NASA dollars looking for life out there, there is still only one example of life in the universe, the DNA-based web of biology on Earth. In this field, said Jill Tarter, an astronomer at the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California, the number two is the all-important number. We count one, two, infinity. We're all looking for number two. But the story of SETI is the story of a dream deferred by politics, a lack of money, and the technological challenges of searching what astronomers call the cosmic haystack. 100 billion stars in the galaxy and 9 billion narrowband radio channels on which aliens, if they exist, might be trying to hail us. Politics and recession have crimped astronomers' budgets and left the Institute's scientists with a kind of siege mentality. Last spring, the University of California ran out of money to run the Hat Creek Observatory, forcing the Allen telescopes into hibernation. In order to continue the search, astronomers are negotiating a deal to share the telescopes with the Air Force, which wants to use them to track satellites and space junk. No federal funds have been spent searching for radio signals from extraterrestrials since 1993. A recent visit to the SETI Institute's Mountain View offices found many of the cubicles empty and the corridors eerily quiet. Last summer, as the Allen telescopes slumbered, weeds grew around them. 998,000 stars to go. The story begins with a young radio astronomer named Frank Drake, who pointed an antenna from the National Radio Astronomy Observatory in Green Bank, West Virginia, at a pair of stars in 1960, wondering if he could make contact with anything or anyone. All he got was static, but the hook was set. In 1971, NASA held a workshop by Barney Oliver, the research chief of Hewlett-Packard, that concluded the best way to find extraterrestrials was with a $10 billion array of giant radio telescopes called Cyclops. The price tag, as well as the subject, set off alarm bells that still reverberate. In 1978, Senator William Proxmire of Wisconsin, an outspoken critic of what could be considered wasteful government spending, awarded one of his infamous Golden Fleece Awards to the Hunt for Aliens in 1993, a NASA-sponsored survey for signals from 1,000 nearby stars, was canceled by Congress. With the help of friends like Dr. Oliver in the Silicon Valley, Dr. Tarter and her colleagues took the search private. As the director of SETI research at the Institute, Dr. Tarter and her colleagues took the search private. As the director of SETI research at the Institute, Dr. Tarter, 67, has become the public face of the cause. And she was consulted by the actress Jodie Foster about her portrayal of Elle Arroway, a radio astronomer who finds a signal in the movie Contact. Dr. Tarter was recruited in 1976 when, as a postdoctorate student at Berkeley, she read the Cyclops report, a rite of passage for most alien-oriented astronomers. She says, "You didn't have to ask a priest or philosopher about life in the universe." But she realized she was in the first generation who could conduct experiments about it. A half century later, and roughly 2,000 stars later, humanity is still officially alone. seems like a sad story, doesn't it? Also in the weird weather category, as we get ready to end our Super Bowl Sunday program here of X Squared Radio, snow fell in Rome today for the first time in 26 years, as freezing temperatures took the death toll across Europe to more than 150. The Italian capital is usually blessed by a moderate climate, but the snowfall prompted authorities to stop visitors from entering the Colosseum, the Roman Forum, and Palatine Hill, the former home of Rome's ancient emperors. The last substantial snowfalls in Rome were in 1985 and 1986, though there have been other cases of lighter snow since then, including in 2010. The director of the Colosseum, Rosella Rea, said the sites were closed out of fears that visitors could slip on ice. Snow began falling in the late morning Friday, leaving a light dusting on trees and cars and forming slush on the roads. And in our drone killing story that we've been running for about a year now, in the advent of Cyberdyne systems-like research that's being done, Congress is calling for accelerated use of drones inside the U.S., A House Senate conference report this week called on the administration to accelerate the use of civilian unmanned aerial systems, or drones, in U.S. airspace. The pending authorization bill for the Federal Aviation Administration directs the Secretary of Transportation to develop within 9 months, that is by September of 2012, a comprehensive plan to safely accelerate the integration of civil unmanned aircraft systems into the national airspace system. The plan shall provide for the safe integration of civil unmanned aircraft systems into the national airspace system as soon as practicable, but not later than September 30th, 2015. The conference bill, which still awaits final passage, also calls for the establishment of UAS test ranges in cooperation with NASA and the Department of Defense, expanded use of UAS in the Arctic region. In the Arctic region, they might be looking for a certain ship looking for an opening into the Earth. Interesting. Development of guidance and for the operation of public unmanned aircraft systems and new safety research to assess the risk of catastrophic failure of the unmanned aircraft that would endanger other aircraft, as well as people on the ground, by the way, in the national airspace system. We wouldn't want one of these things to run out of gas or suddenly nosedive into, say, downtown Cincinnati, now would we? The Department of Defense is pursuing its own domestic UAS activities for training purposes and domestic operations. That would be U.S. operations over your neighborhood. According to a 2007 DOD FAA Memorandum of Agreement. There's an update on this, by the way. In the recently enacted FY 2012, you know what I'm talking about, don't you? Fiscal Year 2012 National Defense Authorization Act, Section 1097. That's the one that Obama signed. You know, the one that says it's okay for the Army to arrest or to hold American citizens without charges for an infinite period of time without due process and export them from the country. Well, they probably could do that anyway before this act, but at least this makes it law. Congress mandated that the administrator of the Federal Aviation Administration shall establish a program to integrate unmanned aircraft systems into the national airspace system at 6 test ranges. This new test range program is supposed to be established within 180 days. 6 months. 6 months, and don't be surprised if you look up and see an unmanned drone following your freeway. It's not just going to be checking your speed either, folks. They're going to be checking for all kinds of stuff. hopefully we're not just hopefully we're just watching our borders. It's not something that we want to see monitoring citizens that are obeying the law and minding their own business. Of course, they would say, well, if you don't have anything to hide, then you have nothing to worry about. Earth explorers, you have something to worry about. We'll see you next week right here on X Squared Radio. Don't go away, my friends. We'll be here next week. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.